here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, November 9th. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:09 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from our UBC campus and from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also today, contributor Sarah Chow talks about stem cells in this week's Simply Science.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
In campus job action news, QP 2278, the Teaching Assistance Union, has reached a tentative agreement with UBC, but have not disclosed the terms of the agreement just yet. The tentative agreement was reached in one day of mediation under the direction of high-profile private mediator Vince Reddy. Michael Stewart, spokesperson for QP 2278, said Vince Reddy played a large role in reaching the deal. He said that although they won't discuss any details of the agreement yet, the TA bargaining committee is recommending they take the deal. The TAs were asking for wage increases, tuition waivers, and hiring preferences for third-year master's and fifth-year PhD students. Stewart said the union will vote on the deal as soon as possible, but there is no date set for the vote just yet. He couldn't predict how the membership would vote on the deal. Stewart said the union's recent job action played a role in how quickly the agreement was reached. Both parties are glad that they were able to come to a deal. UBC spokesperson Lucy McNeil said the agreement required hard work on both sides of the table. McNeil said the negotiations were limited by provincial mandates that restrict wage increases as well as BC's overall economic environment.
A UBC program designed to help veterans make the transition back to civilian life is being expanded into a national nonprofit program. The Veterans Transition Program, started at UBC in 1989, will be renamed the Veterans Transition Network and will expand its service network across the country. This is being made possible by $1.45 million in donations from Veterans Affairs Canada, the Royal Canadian Legion, and other organizations. Marvin Westwood, a UBC education professor and one of the founders of the program, says, quote, "Soldiers returning from service face complex issues and require multiple layers of support. This is one of the best examples of the community, post-secondary, and troops working together to provide an established treatment program that will help modern-day veterans," end quote. Since its inception, the Veteran Transitions Program has aided 275 veterans by reducing trauma symptoms, addressing depression, and increasing self-esteem of soldiers returning from overseas.
Scientists from University of British Columbia, University of Alberta, the University of Toronto, and 11 other leading institutions in India are joining forces to tackle urgent issues in both countries with a $30 million partnership. Supported by the Canadian government and state and industry partners in India, the India-Canada Centre for Innovative Multidisciplinary Partnerships to Accelerate Community Transformation and Sustainability, or IC Impacts, will focus on water safety, disease prevention and treatment, and the development of safe and sustainable civil infrastructure. It will also support new technology spin-offs and the training of more than 700 students and researchers. IC Impacts is expected to build research capacity and solving issues of importance to both countries through the development, deployment, and commercialization of new technologies, and the training and exchange of students and researchers. The partnership was formally launched today in New Delhi by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who was joined by UBC President Stephen Toop, U of T President David Naylor, and U of A Vice President of Research Lauren Babiak.
Researchers at UBC have received an additional $17 million grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to treat women at risk of preeclampsia, the potentially fatal onset of high blood pressure during pregnancy in developing countries. The program, led by Peter von Dadelson, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UBC and a clinician scientist at the Child and Family Research Institute, said the funding will allow researchers to run larger trials in Nigeria, Mozambique, Pakistan, and India, involving 130,000 expectant mothers. The project tests a simple method devised by von Dadelson for diagnosing preeclampsia and assessing the degree of risk. The disorder is easily treated in hospital, but is the second leading cause of maternal death, mainly because women are not properly diagnosed or are not transported to appropriate facilities. The key to this diagnostic and treatment pipeline, extending from remote villages to urban hospitals, is raising community awareness of women's health, the warning signs of illness, and the importance of seeking medical help before emergencies occur.
In other news regarding Remembrance Day, on Sunday, November 11th, UBC will be holding a Remembrance Day ceremony for the community. The ceremony is being held between 10:45 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. and will be held at the War Memorial Gym on University Boulevard. The ceremony, which usually draws about 1,000 members of the community, will include music, readings, and remarks. UBC's Women's Choir, and the Zing Children's Choir will also provide music. The platform party will include J.P. Joyce Murray of the Vancouver Quadra, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Linford, Pastor Christina Louis, UBC Vice President of Communications and Community Partnerships Pascal Spothelfer, University Marshal and Director of the UBC Opera Ensemble Nancy Hermiston, as well as President of Alma Mater Society at UBC Vancouver Matt Parson.
62 people who are at risk of homelessness will have a roof over their heads as a new supportive housing officially opened this Thursday. In addition to the units, the new nine-story tower includes a community resource center, complete with a games and arts room, library, social lounges, dining room, and kitchen. The Sanford Apartments, managed by Catherine Sanford Housing Society, is the seventh completed supportive housing development out of 14 projects in Vancouver.
Support staff at Simon Fraser University and Vancouver Community College staged picket lines in campuses in Burnaby and Vancouver yesterday. Nearly 1,500 workers at both SFU and VCC were affected by the walkout. The one-day walkout by unionized support staff caused transit delays and canceled classes at two major Vancouver post-secondary institutions Wednesday, but union members believe that students are on their side and they hope to strike a fair deal. School was canceled at VCC, and some SFU classes were affected. Bus routes at Burnaby Mountain were also altered because of disruption. Joe Hansen, chief shop steward with QP Local 4627, said despite the disruption, students have expressed support for the job action. Metro News Vancouver quoted her as saying, "We have not always seen eye to eye with the students or even the faculty association, but we are rock solid together this time. This is also the first time the support workers have really said that they are not stopping until we get to the end of this," end quote. Hansen said other colleges are readying for a strike vote and could put even more pressure on the employers and the provincial government. Christian Avendano, with the Students' Union of Vancouver Community College, said the job action is a direct result of underfunding of post-secondary education by the provincial government. He said he hopes that the parties reach an agreement soon to avoid further cancelled classes.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines here on News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your provincial and national headlines, as well as your weekend weather forecast.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
CITR is celebrating the 75th anniversary of UBC Radio Excellence, 30 years on the FM dial, and 30 years of Discorder magazine. Your one and only CITR 101.9 FM is inviting all CITR alumni and friends to our alumni weekend this November 16th and 17th. On the 16th, we'll be kicking it live on location at Perch on 337 Hastings around 5 p.m. for some beers, cheers, and cooling with peers. The 17th, come to Thea's Lounge for some Give Us Your Love brunch at 11 a.m. Find out more about what's going down at the station and the progress we have made over the years. Shortly after, join us for tours of our beloved station and learn about our space in the new sub. Come to our birthday party on Saturday evening at Chapel Arts with CITR alumni Lisa Marr and Culture Shock performing, as well as Gang Signs, Fine Mist, Carolyn Mark, and Channels 3 and 4. Reminisce about the good old days, bumping the shows of the past, as we have dedicated this special weekend to hearing our alumni on the airwaves. So come and cool out with us on the freaking weekend and have you some fun. But don't forget to register for events. Visit CITR.ca for more details.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. You can also listen to us live online at CITR.ca. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for your local weekend weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. The general conditions for today is a high pressure cell spanning over a large portion of Canada from BC to Ontario. That is great, as it is reflected in our general good weather today. Tomorrow is likely a bright sunny day too, according to our rooftop model, which predicts no cloud cover and rising pressure. However, a rain band can be seen in the distance, expecting to land in about 60 hours into the future once the high pressure ridge subsides. Now, here are the conditions and temperature forecast from Environment Canada for this weekend. Today, mainly sunny with a high of 9 degrees. Tonight, a few clouds, a low of 0 degrees, so it will get quite chilly. Make sure to dress warm. Saturday, mainly sunny with a high of plus 5. Sunday, expect a slight rain with a low of minus 1 and a high of 7. And that's the weather for this weekend from the UBC Storm Club and Environment Canada. You are listening to News 101. We now go to Simply Science, brought to you by Sarah Chow. This week, it's about stem cells.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. Cells grow and cells die, but this can be a big problem, especially when they can't grow back. This is the case for those who have spinal cord injuries, heart attacks, strokes, and other neurological diseases like Parkinson's disease. Stem cells have the potential to save it all. You see, stem cells are unspecialized cells that can develop into specialized cells, like a heart cell or a kidney cell. They are unlike regular cells, which can only replicate to create their own type. For example, a skin cell can only replicate into another skin cell, or sometimes they can't replicate at all. And this year's Nobel Prize goes to...
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute has today decided to award the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine 2012 jointly to John B. Gurdon and Shinya Yamanaka for the discovery that mature cells can be reprogrammed to become pluripotent.
Although both Sir John B. Gurdon and Dr. Shinya Yamanaka won for their work on stem cells, what they found was different. It was originally thought when organs or tissues were formed, genes are dropped. For example, skin cells don't need heart or brain genes, so it is assumed they just disappeared. But Sir John B. Gurdon found otherwise. He found that all cells in the body actually have the same genes, despite the type of cells they are. He proved this by replacing the nucleus of a frog egg with one from an intestinal cell. The new cell was then transplanted back into a frog, and lo and behold, the egg hatched into a normal frog. From this experiment, he showed specialized cells can become unspecialized. Dr. Yamanaka took a different approach. He found four genes that hold the key to turning back the time on cells and reverting them back to immature cells, or stem cells, so they can be manipulated again to redevelop into something different. Now, what's interesting about both types of research is that it answers a very basic question in science. In other words, Sir John B. Gurdon isn't directly looking for a cure for spinal cord injuries using stem cells. What he's interested in is how can a cell that has already been programmed to be an intestinal cell, when inserted to a frog egg, grow into a frog? What is the fundamental processes or mechanisms that are going on? And that's what we call in the sciences basic science. And it's incredibly important. But because it's so basic, funding for basic science can be hard, because clinical applications can be years and years away. But here's what Dr. Gurdon had to say.
In general, if you answer a fundamental basic question in biology, it's very unlikely that this will not prove useful in the end. So basic science discoveries almost always have a therapeutic value eventually.
Another interesting fact about Dr. Gurdon is that he didn't do so well in science class in high school. In fact, Bob McDonald of CBC's Quirks and Quarks asked him about his report card.
Many people have been enjoying your school report card from 1949, and your biology instructor says, and I quote, "I believe he has ideas about becoming a scientist. On his present showing, this is quite ridiculous. It would be a waste of time, both on his part and of those who have to teach him." So was your science master wrong, or did you turn over a new leaf?
Well, I think the teaching was bad or very difficult to follow at the time. I'd actually always had an interest in biological matters in spite of that report. In fact, I retained that interest even after I'd been removed from science by the school. So I think there were several problems. One was, you see, that this was so soon after the war, we had no textbooks. We just had to listen to what the schoolmaster said, and if you were lucky, you made correct notes. But if you didn't make correct notes, you were bound to fail all the next tests that you were subjected to. And that's really what happened in my case.
So that just shows you, grades aren't everything. Determination and passion are. Well, that's it for this week. For Simply Science, for CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for bringing us that Simply Science segment. You can, of course, listen to it once again on our website, citr.ca/news, or check it out on our Mixcloud page. And it is now time for your provincial and national headlines here on News 101.
Energy giant Kinder Morgan is holding public consultations across the Lower Mainland over the next several weeks, bringing its proposed Trans Mountain pipeline expansion under public scrutiny. With the company's next information session today, or rather 2 days ago, November 7th, in West Vancouver, proponents and activists alike are set to share their views with company officials over its proposal to more than double the pipeline's output from 300,000 to 750,000 barrels a day, including boosting Brevard Inlet oil tanker traffic through Kinder Morgan's Burnaby Terminal. While environmentalists, First Nations, and the mayors of Vancouver and Burnaby have expressed opposition to the project, The company insists that safety is a top priority and criticisms are being heard. The West Vancouver Open House on the 7th was followed by sessions, or will be followed, sorry, by sessions in East Vancouver on the 13th, downtown Vancouver on the 15th, and West Point Grey on November 17th, and other Lower Mainland cities later this month.
Members of the British Columbia Government and Service Employees Union voted 64% in favor of ratifying an agreement with the provincial government. Both the government and the union put out press releases calling the agreement a success. However, the union's release repeated that they were frustrated by the government's refusal to pay the full cost of members' professional fees. Ratification voting started on October 22nd, but the BCGEU's chief negotiator, David Vipon, sent a letter dated October 31st to the province complaining that while the employer had refused to pay BCGEU's members' professional fees at 2011 and 2012 levels, it did agree to do so for the Professional Employees Association. The deal provides some 26,000 direct government employees with 4 wage increases of 1% each on April 1st, 2012, August 15th, 2012, April 1st, 2013, and December 1st, 2013. And that also ends a plan to privatize part of the liquor distribution system.
A National Women's Aboriginal Conference held last week in Winnipeg has concluded without any major resolutions. Although participants demanded action on missing and murdered Aboriginal women, their demands for federal public inquiry into the issue resulted only in promises by provincial and territorial ministers to examine it further. The National Aboriginal Women's Summit included ministers responsible for justice, Aboriginal affairs, or the status of women from every province and territory. It also included officials from national Aboriginal groups, such as the Assembly of First Nations, who were noticeably absent from the closing news conference. Aboriginal groups have called for a national inquiry into the estimated 600 Aboriginal women who have disappeared or been killed in the last 2 decades. They say an inquiry could examine how police investigated missing persons cases and what effect poverty and other socioeconomic factors have on Aboriginal women. The provincial and territorial ministers did not commit to push the federal government for such an inquiry. In the end, the ministers agreed on a series of steps that primarily involve more discussion. A joint communique released at the end of the meeting called for a meeting of Aboriginal Affairs and Justice Ministers in the spring of 2013, which will work toward a national framework of action, further debate at the spring meeting about a possible national inquiry, and an examination of changes to further strengthen protection for Aboriginal women and girls, among other points.
The BC Premier has pledged to fully cooperate should a conflict of interest probe be launched into her role in the controversial BC Rail sale. Questions have dogged the Premier over the 9 years since she served as Education Minister and Deputy Premier when the railway was up for sale in a process that ultimately ended in scandal. Independent MLA John Van Dongen has again brought the issue to the fore this week by asking the Office of the Conflict of Interest Commissioner to investigate. Van Dongen has supplied the office with a 20-page brief and large binder of documents he compiled on his own accord. His letter to the commissioner suggests that while Clark made known she was taking action to avoid a potential conflict of interest in relation to BC Rail on some occasions, there were instances where she did not. Premier Clark said she thinks it's time the issue be settled with a final opinion from the conflict commissioner.
And those are your provincial and national headlines for today. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us, and we'll be right back with Democracy Now!
CITR 101.9 FM is pleased to invite you to a birthday party celebrating 75 years of campus and community radio excellence for 30 years on the FM dial and 30 years of Discorder magazine. We've got a lineup of bands and exhibits to celebrate CITR's 75-year history of independent radio and support of local independent music, including Miss Mar and Friends, Culture Shock, Fine Mist, Channels 3 and 4, Karen and Mark, and the new Best Friends and more. Doors open at 8, bands at 9, tickets for $10 in advance or $12 at the door plus voluntary donation. This party is one part of our alumni weekend, and if you are an alumni, past volunteer, or current member, or are connected to the history of the station, this event is for you. For more details, visit CITR.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. You can also listen to us online at citr.ca/listen. We now go to Democracy Now! For their international headlines. Apologies about that. We are having some technical difficulties due to a buffering issue. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Once again, you can listen to our past segments and interviews that we conducted on Monday on our website, citr.ca/news. We now go back to Democracy Now! For their international headlines.
More coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman on the road in Chicago. The Pentagon's confirmed that Iran fired at a pilotless U.S. drone last week but missed its target. Pentagon spokesperson George Little insisted the incident occurred in international, not Iranian airspace, and vowed U.S. surveillance flights will continue.
The incident occurred over international waters, approximately 16 nautical miles off the Iranian coastline. The MQ-1 was not hit and returned to its base safely. The United States has communicated to the Iranians that we will continue to conduct surveillance flights over international waters, over the Arabian Gulf, consistent with longstanding practice and our commitment to the security of the region. We have a wide range of options, from diplomatic to military, to protect our military assets and our forces in the region, and will do so when necessary.
The news comes as the Obama administration announced a new round of sanctions against Iran, its first foreign policy initiative since Tuesday's election. The 2012 election has officially come to a close after a final vote count confirmed President Obama won the state of Florida. Mitt Romney's campaign conceded Florida on Thursday, with Obama ahead by over 58,000 votes. Obama's final Electoral College tally was 332 votes to Romney's 206. Video has been released of President Obama breaking into tears as he thanks workers and volunteers at his Chicago campaign headquarters. Obama made the visit the day after he won re-election.
Even before last night's results, I felt that the work that I had done in running for office had come full circle. Because what you guys have done means that the work that I'm doing is important. And I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of all of you. And what you described.
President Obama is expected to deliver his first address since his victory speech later today with a statement on the economy. Topping Obama's post-election domestic agenda is the so-called fiscal cliff of $700 billion in expiring tax cuts and automatic spending reductions set to take effect at the end of the year. Under the terms of last year's debt deal, Obama and Senate Democrats must agree on a deficit reduction package with House Republicans or face automatic cuts that will likely contract the economy. On Thursday, a new study from the Congressional Budget Office said Obama's call for ending the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans while maintaining the cuts for lower-income brackets will not hinder economic growth. Republicans have insisted on preserving tax cuts for the rich under any deficit reduction package, claiming it would protect jobs. But the nonpartisan CBO estimates the move would reduce job growth by as much as 200,000, far less than the 700,000 cited by House Speaker John Boehner. More than 761,000 homes and businesses remained without power on the East Coast Thursday after a powerful nor'easter knocked out electricity for tens of thousands, on top of those still in the dark from Superstorm Sandy. The number includes more than 20,000 residents of public housing in New York City, who in some cases also lack heat and running water. Three of New York City's hospitals remain closed after losing power during the storm, and there's no current timetable for their reopening. On Thursday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said economic damage from the storm could reach $50 billion.
The first cost estimate that I have seen has suggested that this storm will cost the region $50 billion in damage and economic loss. State of New York, about $33 billion in damage and economic loss. That is a staggering number.
In the face of an ongoing fuel shortage, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has unveiled a new rationing system for the purchase of gas. On Thursday, Bloomberg said motorists will only be able to purchase gas on alternating days, depending on whether their license plate ends in odd or even numbers.
If only 25% of our gas stations, we estimate, are open, drivers are still facing long lines. Frustrations are only growing, and it now appears that there will be shortages for possibly another couple weeks. The best way, we think, to cut down the lines and help customers buy gas faster, to help gas stations stay open longer, and to reduce the potential for disorder, is to alternate the days that drivers can purchase gas.
Arizona shooter Jared Loughner has been sentenced to life in prison for the rampage in Tucson last year that killed six people and wounded 13 others, including former Democratic Congressmember Gabrielle Giffords. Under a plea deal reached earlier this year, Loughner will spend the rest of his life in prison with no chance of parole. John Leonardo, the U.S. attorney for Arizona, said prosecutors decided not to seek capital punishment because of Loughner's mental health.
For the family members of those who were killed and for those that survived this terrible event, it is our hope that the final resolution of this case will be a positive step towards their healing process, physically, emotionally, and psychologically. It was with them in mind that we entered into this plea agreement with the defendant. We also believe that this sentence is appropriate in light of Jared Loughner's severe mental illness. It seems likely that had Mr. Loughner not suffered from mental illness of schizophrenia, he would not have committed these horrific acts.
At Thursday's court hearing, Loughner faced a number of his victims, including Gabrielle Giffords and her former congressional aide, Ron Barber. Barber spoke to reporters after the sentencing.
And then I turned to Mr. Loughner and said, I hold no hatred for you, but I am very, very angry and sick at heart about what you did and the hurt you have imposed on all of us. I told him that he must now live with this burden and we'll never see outside of a prison again. And I said, in the end, I hope that these long years of incarceration that you face will give you the time to think about what you have done and to seek forgiveness from those whose lives you brought so much tears and so much sadness.
In international news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is said to be confronting a new diplomatic challenge with President Obama's reelection. After publicly defying the Obama administration on West Bank settlements, pushing for a military attack on Iran, and even appearing to back Mitt Romney in the presidential race, Netanyahu is facing pressure from within his government to repair strained Israeli-U.S. ties. Hours after Obama's victory, Israel's deputy prime minister, Eli Yishai, said, quote, "This has not been a very good morning for Netanyahu." Later in the day, Netanyahu staged a news conference with U.S. Ambassador Dan Shapiro to publicly congratulate Obama on his win.
I want to congratulate President Obama on his re-election. Mm-hmm. I think the United States of America again demonstrated why it's the greatest democracy on earth. The security relationship between the United States and Israel is rock solid, and I look forward to working with President Obama to further strengthen this relationship. And I look forward to working with him to advance our goals of peace and security.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu followed up his comments with a personal telephone call to Obama on Thursday. One of the first tests of Obama's post-election Middle East foreign policy will come this month as the Palestinian Authority seeks non-member status at the United Nations, which the U.S. forcefully opposed last year. The move would grant Palestinians recognition at bodies like the International Criminal Court, where they could potentially bring cases against Israel. If approved, the move could trigger a U.S. law that would force the defunding of the PA and even the entire United Nations. On Thursday, the Palestinian Authority went ahead with its efforts, circulating a draft resolution for recognition to UN members. In news from the occupied territories, a Palestinian boy was killed Thursday in an Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip. The boy was shot as Israeli troops exchanged fire with Palestinian militants near the Israel-Gaza border. The White House has announced President Obama will visit Burma later this month. As part of the administration's efforts to unfreeze ties with the ruling military junta, Obama's visit will mark the first to Burma by a sitting U.S. president. Activists in Arizona are challenging the re-election of the controversial sheriff, Joe Arpaio, citing a large amount of uncounted ballots. Arpaio has faced widespread accusations of discrimination and civil rights abuses against Latinos, as well as financial misconduct. Election officials in Maricopa County have acknowledged some 415,000 early and provisional ballots remain uncounted, a total that could wipe out Arpaio's election victory of 88,000 votes. Activists have been holding vigils outside the Maricopa County Recorder's office, demanding that the votes be counted and alleging Election Day irregularities. A man claiming to be a business owner in Las Vegas has publicly announced he's fired 22 of his more than 114 mostly Hispanic employees because of President Obama's re-election. Speaking anonymously to the radio station KSNT, the man blamed the expected costs of President Obama's health care law.
I explained to them a month ago, if Obama gets in office, the regulations for Obamacare are going to hurt our business. And I'm going to have to make provisions to make sure I have enough money to cover the payroll taxes, the additional health care I'm going to have to do. And I explained that to them, and I says, you do what you feel in your heart you need to do, but I'm just letting you know as a warning, this is things that I have to think of as a business owner. Well, unfortunately, and most of my employees are Hispanic. I'm not going to go into what company I have, but I have mostly Hispanic employees. Well, unfortunately, we know what happened. I can't wait around anymore. I need to be proactive. I had to lay off 22 people today to make sure that my business is going to thrive and that I'm going to be around for years to come.
A suspect has been arrested in Michigan for a spate of shooting attacks that terrorized residents of the town of Wixom. Raleigh Wayne Castile is accused of carrying out 24 random shootings at motorists driving along the Interstate 96 corridor. Only one person was wounded in the attacks over the course of 3 weeks. And a federal appeals court has dismissed a lawsuit against former U.S. Secretary of State of Defense Donald Rumsfeld for his role in crafting policies that led to torture in Iraq. In an 8-3 decision, the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled two American citizens allegedly tortured at a U.S. military base in Iraq have no right to sue Rumsfeld and other U.S. officials. The plaintiffs, Donald Vance and Nathan Ertel, were reportedly arrested and tortured after collaborating with the FBI in an investigation of their employer in Iraq, the private security company Shield Group Security. The two men were eventually released and never charged with a crime. Wednesday's decision overturns two previous court rulings allowing the case to proceed. The Obama administration followed the Bush administration in seeking the lawsuit's dismissal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For those international headlines. For more international headlines, we now go to Free Speech Radio News.
Fasarin. CIA head David Petraeus announced today he is stepping down from his post. In a letter to employees, he admitted to having an extramarital affair and said, quote, such behavior is unacceptable, both as a husband and as the leader of an organization such as ours. Petraeus had been in the position for a little over a year. While cities on the East Coast continue to rebuild after the damaging floods of Hurricane Sandy, New York City is experiencing a drought of sorts. It has a critical gas shortage. FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports on new efforts announced this morning to combat the problem.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg imposed gas rationing on the city 11 days after Hurricane Sandy pounded one of the most densely populated areas of the world.
The best way, we think, to cut down the lines and help customers buy gas faster, to help gas stations stay open longer, and to reduce the potential for disorder, is to alternate the days that drivers can purchase gas.
Parts of New Jersey already have a similar rationing plan in place, which restricts who's allowed to pump based on license plate number. Since gas stations reopened in New York City, people have waited in line for hours. The rationing could pose serious problems for residents, especially those who still don't have electricity and need the gas to run generators for heat. Nighttime temperatures are expected to drop into the 30s early next week. Only 25% of gas stations in the city remain open. Bloomberg said the shortage could go on for weeks. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
4 years ago, after Barack Obama won his first term, the streets of some Virginia cities were filled with young people celebrating the historic win. This year, however, after Mitt Romney's loss was announced, a crowd gathered at a rural Central Virginia college where racial slurs replaced excited chants. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story.
Late Tuesday night, a crowd of about 40 Hampton Sydney College students gathered around the school's minority union. Students threw bottles, set off fireworks, and yelled racial slurs. A student member of the minority union told a local NBC affiliate he hadn't heard the N-word being used that much in a while, just a constant barrage of it. The following night, Hampton Sydney's president, Chris Howard, held a town hall meeting with students to discuss what happened. Community members also attended. A university investigation is underway. This was the second reported aggressive campus protest associated with the election. More than 400 students gathered at the University of Mississippi shortly after Obama's win was announced. They yelled racial slurs and burned at least one Obama sign. Two were arrested. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
In the country,
two men filed suit this week in Hawaii, alleging church sex abuse under a landmark state law that permits civil actions to be brought by persons subjected to sexual offenses as minors, even though the statute of limitations had previously lapsed. FSRN's Larry Geller reports from Honolulu.
Act 68, passed by the Hawaii legislature earlier this year, opens a 2-year window during which lawsuits by child victims of sexual abuse may be filed. The law allows victims to seek justice no matter when the alleged abuse took place. Only California and Delaware have similar laws. The two Honolulu men are accusing a former Catholic school employee of sexual abuse and charged that the school and the Honolulu Catholic Diocese engaged in a cover-up. The alleged offenses took place in 1984 and 1986. It can take victims of sexual abuse many years to become able to pursue a case in court, and during that time, statutes of limitations often expire. The Roman Catholic Church opposed the Hawaii law and has worked to prevent similar legislation from passing in other states as well. Larry Geller, FSRN, Honolulu.
Anti-government groups marched in Argentina's capital last night. An FSRN reporter who witnessed the pot banging of the so-called casserole protest said people packed and blocked an 18-lane highway for several blocks. Media report as many as 1 million marched in the largest anti-government protest in years. Demonstrators are angry about the economy, corruption, and rumors that the president is trying to change the law to run for a third term. Prosecutors in Turkey are wrapping up the trial of four top Israeli commanders in absentia for the deaths of nine activists killed in May 2010 aboard a humanitarian aid ship bound for Gaza. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
As part of a flotilla attempting to break Israel's blockade on the Gaza Strip, the Mavi Marmara was still in international waters when Israeli forces boarded and seized the ship. Nine people aboard were killed. Footage shot by activists aboard shows passengers throwing objects at Israeli commandos as they made the nighttime assault on the ship.
Suddenly we heard shouting and people start shouting Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, and then I saw helicopters above us and Zodiacs coming.
I'm Jess Burns.
That's Nufitri Tayer, a 36-year-old translator from Indonesia. She was with the Medical Emergency Rescue Committee, one of the many Islamic NGOs aboard the vessel. She's one of nearly 500 witnesses here in Istanbul this week to give testimony. The Israeli commanders are being tried in absentia, and Israel's government has dismissed the proceedings as a show trial. The Turkish government continues to seek a formal apology and compensation for the victims, as well as an end to the blockade. Israel has voiced regret and offered a humanitarian fund, but both concessions fall short of Turkey's demands. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
And that's headlines for FSRN from Eugene, Oregon. China's government is undergoing a transition of power this week as Communist Party elite meet in Beijing to select their new leadership. The party congress opened today with outgoing president Hu Jintao warning the party about the pitfalls of corruption and setting sights on turning the country into a maritime power. Xi Jinping is slated to take over as president. The Congress opens as at least five Tibetans have self-immolated in the past 2 days in protest of Chinese rule in their country. The five are all young, between the ages of 15 and 23, and include one woman. The government had reportedly broadcast warnings across Tibet, saying any attempt to disrupt the party Congress would be crushed by any means. Communities in Guatemala are looking for survivors after a powerful earthquake caused severe destruction to the region near the Mexican border. The BBC reports 52 are dead, 22 people are still missing, and as many as 10,000 homes have been destroyed. In one village, 10 members of the same family died when their house collapsed. Power is out in many areas, and roads have been destroyed. The 7.4 magnitude quake was centered just off the Pacific coast. Turkey says it will consider a policy to allow Kurds appearing in court to use their own language in their defense. This is a major demand of hundreds of Kurdish prisoners on a hunger strike now entering its 58th day. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
International pressure is increasing as more than 650 Kurdish prisoners continue to refuse food. They are subsisting on vitamins, sugar, and water. Prisoners connected to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party launched the hunger strike, calling for improved conditions for their jailed leader, Abdullah Öcalan, who is being held incommunicado on a remote island. They also demand the right to defend themselves in court using their mother tongue. The Turkish Republic doesn't recognize its ethnic minorities. Kurds, who unofficially comprise close to a fifth of the population, are denied basic language and cultural rights. This week, Turkey's justice minister announced that a draft law allowing the Kurdish language in courts would be sent to lawmakers as soon as the prime minister returns from a trip to Indonesia. This comes as a coalition of leftist parliamentarians from the European Union warned Turkey that the hunger strike could harm future relations. Doctors have warned the health of the striking inmates is deteriorating rapidly. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
International election observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe were in the U.S. on Election Day. In preliminary findings released Wednesday, the group said the electoral process was competitive and transparent, but not immune to criticism. From D.C., FSRN's Michael Lawson reports.
Over 6 weeks, 44 observers went to 40 different locations throughout the U.S. on behalf of the OSCE's Office of Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. They focused on voter rights and registration, campaign finance, and election administration. Their report says some 50 million eligible voters are not registered, and that nearly 6 million citizens were disenfranchised because of a criminal conviction, including 2.6 million who have served their sentence, a finding at odds with the group's principle of universal suffrage. Observers did not criticize voter ID laws, but say having the rules finalized only weeks before the election is not good practice. OSCE also cited limited ballot access for third-party candidates and the decentralized nature of the election as potential problems. The international organization's monitoring efforts were met with resistance from officials in Texas and Iowa. This, it said, was out of step with free election principles. A final report will be issued early next year. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
Across the country, voters have defeated several state education measures aimed at reforming public schools. In South Dakota, 67% of voters said they did not want to restrict teacher tenure or set teacher evaluation guidelines. Sandy Arsenault is president of the South Dakota Education Association, which had the law referred to the ballot.
The rights for teachers in South Dakota are not the strong union rights that you see across other states in the nation, and I believe what we have is very minimal, and they should respect us enough to leave those alone.
In Idaho, voters defeated three education initiatives targeting collective bargaining rights, technology, and online credit requirements. FSRN's Lee Robartis has the story from Moscow.
Governor Butch Otter, who along with his superintendent of public instruction Tom Luna were eyed as possible Romney cabinet members, were instead handed a rebuke by voters on the issue that had dominated Idaho politics for the last 2 years. Proposition 3, which covered technology, was rejected by 67% of the voters, and the no votes were 57 and 58% on the other measures. Democratic State Representative Shirley Ringo, a teachers union member, says two reasons for the defeat are lawmakers failed to get buy-in from teachers and sticker shock on the laptop program.
Idaho is a conservative state, and I think that the cost of Proposition 3 could have been one thing that sort of snowballed and really got the votes rolling against all three of them, actually.
Ringo says voters were also suspicious of major financial supporters of the education overhaul, some with ties to privatized online schooling. Lee Robartis, FSRN, Moscow, Idaho.
And finally, the trial of Bradley Manning continues in a military court in Maryland. Yesterday, Manning offered to plead guilty to a lesser set of charges, according to his lawyer, David Coombs. Coombs says this is not part of a plea deal with the government. The court may or may not accept the plea. Manning is accused of leaking thousands of classified and sensitive documents to WikiLeaks. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found on their website, fsrn.org. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for Friday, November 9th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our emails, news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and every Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Morgan Yee and myself. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for sports broadcasting live from the basketball event. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM.